So the next presentation will be by Keith Ziglenka, and the title of his talk is Histone H3 Lysine 4 Dimethylation in Sperm is Implicated in Embryo Development and Transgenerational Epigenetic Inheritance.
Okay. So it's long been known that paternal effects can influence offspring health. However, the underlying mechanism is unknown. Recent evidence has shown that parental or paternal exposure to a low-fat or high-fat diet or a low folate diet, as well as toxicants such as BPA, can influence can cause or lead to epigenetic intergenerational or transgenerational inheritance. It's widely known that the transmission, or it's widely accepted that the transmission may occur through the sperm epigenome. However, there's many large gaps in knowledge. Currently, there's no connection between the sperm epigenome and offspring health. Moreover, there's no idea, really, of what the function of the epigenetic modifications are in sperm. Moreover, we don't currently know or have any data showing how epigenetic effects are the mechanism behind how epigenetic effects persist across multiple generations. Now, just a brief background on how the sperm chromatin is uniquely organized. Only about 1 to 10% of nucleosomes are retained in sperm. Now, this retention is highly organized and predictable, where we have high regions of CpG content, hypomethylated DNA, and high levels of transcription are regions where we see the most retention of nucleosomes. Now recent work from Dr. Antoine Peters' group, as well as others, have shown that important histone marks, such as histone methylation and H3K4 di and trimethylation, are retained specifically at the transcriptional start sites of genes involved in cellular homeostasis and development. Moreover, other genes involved in development have histone methylation marks H3K27 trimethylation retained. Now, therefore, this serves to build our hypothesis that histone modifications in sperm serve a function in development and transmission of paternal effects. To test this hypothesis, we created a transgenic overexpression mouse model that overexpresses KDM1A specifically in the testes. Now, KDM1A is naturally expressed in the testes, and targets H3K4 mono and dimethylation. Here we see that our overexpression model only expresses in the testes, and in situ hybridization shows expression of our transgene in spermatogonia, spermatocytes, round spermatids, and elongated spermatids. I'd like to point out at this point that spermatogenesis is normal in mice, and they are fertile. So we created two transgenic lines that were heterozygous, and we always breed the males to a C57 black 6 female. This creates two experimental groups, the first being those with the transgene, shown in this half-moon circle, as well as those that are the wild-type littermate brothers that do not contain the transgene themselves, but are a descendant of the transgenic father. And we call these non-transgenics. And we breed both these experimental groups for multiple generations. Now, the most striking finding of the initial characteristics of our model is that we have a progressive reduction in survivability in both transgenic lines. So what I'm showing you here is the survivability plots over the first 21 days of life of the animals sired by transgenic and non-transgenic males. In comparison to the black and control, we see that in red, litter sired by transgenic males have only about 70% rate of survival after 20 days, 21 days. Now, interestingly, in the subsequent generation, animals sired by the next generation of transgenics have even further reduced rates of survivability at only about 40% surviving. This is the same effect in line two. Now, what's really interesting is that we also see this reduced rate in survivability occurring in our non-transgenic animals, where we have in blue only about 75% of litters surviving. Now, if we think that epigenetic reprogramming is complete between generations, these non-transgenic animals should not have a reduced rate of survivability. But this is the first evidence that we had showing that we have a transgenerational effect. Now, to further characterize the reason for reduced rates of survivability, we analyzed litters at embryonic day 18.5 for animals sired by both transgenic and non-transgenics. Now, we saw that there was a widespread abnormalities observed. Now, in comparison to the control, we see abnormalities such as patterning defects, a limb abnormality, and extra digits, egg-shaped cranial facial heads, hemorrhagic foci, edematous tissue, runting, abnormal limb development, and many other abnormalities. But to determine for how many generations these abnormalities persisted, we analyzed the embryos at E18.5 for multiple generations of non-transgenic breedings. So here we see that frequency of pregnancy loss per group is significantly increased for two generations of litter sired by non-transgenic males. We also see that rates of total abnormal embryos per group is also increased for two generations of non-transgenic males. What we see by the third generation is a reduction in these rates of abnormalities or pregnancy loss, suggesting that the epigenetic effect is eventually cleared or reset after three generations. What we saw was the most persistent abnormal phenotype was a craniofacial abnormality, and therefore we highlighted these using a skeletal stain approach. In this top panel here, we see the red is bone and blue is cartilage. And for what we did is we took embryos from E18.5 from a subset of these males, from a subset of litters sired from non-transgenic 1 and non-transgenic 2 males. And we see many abnormalities such as micronathia, reduced ossification, missing mandibles, elongated snouts, as well as egg-shaped head and missing mandibles. Now, because we overexpress KDM1A specifically in the germ cells, we wanted to see how exactly was the chromatin state altered. To do this, we used a chip sequencing approach against the natural target of KDM1A, H3K4 dimethylation. Here I'm showing you chip sequencing data in the first panel against H3K4 dimethylation in the transgenic sperm. In blue, we show the read counts or relative enrichment levels across this along this specific gene, Guscoid homeobox. Now, in the transgenic sperm, we see where the arrow shows a specific depletion of H3K4 dimethylation directly at the transcriptional start site. This is not observed in our control animals' sperm. If we compare this to reference genomes and chip sequencing data, we see that it is also enriched in regions that are high in H3K4 trimethylation, H3K27 trimethylation, and the histone variant H3.3, as well as the normal binding site of KDM1A. Rather than focus on the individual genes, I want to show you across the whole genome where we've lost H3K4 dimethylation specifically at the transcriptional start sites. We're going to do this by showing you through a heat map. Hopefully you can see okay, but in the bright colors is regions where we have high levels, and the dark blue is where we have the most losses. Each of these lanes are centered around the transcriptional start site, and right and left of the lane is plus or minus 3 kilobase pairs. And now right away we see for H3K4 dimethylation, a trough directly along the transcriptional start site in the transgenic sperm. This is not observed in the control animals. We see that we can superimpose exactly along the transcriptional start site the normal binding sites of KDM1A. Moreover, these regions are rich in CpG as well as retained nucleosomes. And the nucleosome variant H3.3, which is an activating nucleosome variant. We don't see any enrichment of H3.1 and H3.2, the canonical histone variants. But we also see that there's a clustering of co-enrichment of H3K4 trimethylation and genes also with H3K27 trimethylation. I just wanted to mention also that although we see the trough in the transgenic males, we do not see this specific depletion in the non-transgenic animals, suggesting that the nucleosomes or the histones are not exactly transmitting this phenotype. When we look at the functional analysis of the genes that cluster together with H3K27, we see that many of them are involved in developmental pathways, such as kidney morphogenesis, skeletal system morphogenesis, and embryonic pattern specification. Now, this is quite resemblant to our phenotype that we saw in our skeletons and embryos. Now, because we've changed the histone landscape, we want to see if perhaps we've also altered indirectly the methylation patterns of DNA. To do this, we employed multiple approaches, the first being two genome-wide approaches using methyl dip sequencing and reduced representation bisulfite sequencing. I'm not going to show you any of the data today, but we did not see any significant changes. And the second approach was a targeted approach using a sequenome mass array epityper, which we looked at the targeted sites that have the greatest loss of H3K4 dimethylation. Again, we saw just as an example of two genes across the 500 base pair region that we looked at in the epityper, we see that at individual CpGs, there are no differences in methylation patterns between transgenic, non-transgenic, and control animals. So I want to conclude with a recap of what we have done. We have overexpressed KDM1A, specifically in the testes, that cause major reduction of H3K4 dimethylation in the transcriptional start sites of our sperm. Now, this creates persistent abnormalities in both transgenic and non-transgenic sired offspring that are essentially transgenerational. Now, this is exciting because it's the first study to show that the proper balance of histone methylation in the sperm is essential for development of the next generation. But how do we explain this phenotype? Well, currently, we believe that sperm histone homeostasis is implicated in gene regulation and offspring development, and that there's a high complexity and crosstalk system between histones, RNA, and DNA transcription. So thank you. I just want to thank everyone in the lab, past and present members, as well as our collaborators, many collaborators, especially those at FMI and Dr. Peter's group, and those that have worked in Jaketa Trasler's group on the DNA methylation. So thank you very much.
All right, so we have time for maybe one or two questions.
Thank you very much. Very interesting story. I have a quite practical question. What was the cutoff for declaring there is a change in the levels of H3K for dimethylated, and what size effects we are talking here about?
So you're asking about the cutoff?
Well, what is the size of the effect? Because you say higher, lower, but for someone who will do the same kind of work or similar work, it would be interesting. Is it 15%? Is it 50% difference?
Our cutoff for the fold change was log 2 fold change, or 1.4 fold change. And that's standard biological relevance for this type of data.
So I have a question that may be clarified. It's a technical thing. I'm not into the sperm field, but you're saying about a transgenerational effect, and you have your transgenic, which is showing embryonic defects, and even in the litter they have abnormalities. So then are you taking those abnormal litter and mating them back to wild-type females and then seeing the same embryonic defects?
Yeah, I can go back to the...
I mean, they're fertile even though they have all these abnormalities, and you can collect the sperm or mate them back into the females.
Yeah.
And they're still transgenic though, right?
Well, that's the thing. We're showing the transgenerational effect through the non-transgenic group of animals. So we breed our transgenic males to a wild-type female, and we get the non-transgenic animal. And then we breed the ones that survive to a C57 Black 6 again for multiple generations. So these are the non-transgenic 1, 2, and 3 that have been bred without the transgene. But they have, in this case, a great-grandfather that has a transgenic, that has a transgene.
Okay, thanks.
Have you looked at the methylation patterns in the non-transgenic?
Yeah, we've looked at methylation patterns in two generations of non-transgenic.
And do they, so they look like the transgenetically changed ones?
Do you mean DNA methylation?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's there's no differences. We haven't seen any differences to the controls.
But does it progressively get back to like the normal control, like the control?
We don't see any differences compared to the wild type.
Okay, so my first question is just to clarify the previous one. The animals you are breeding do not have any morphological defects, or they do have morphological defects?
They do and they don't. We take the ones that survive, and we take them
I'm going to change my question. So the ones that do have morphological defects, do those morphological defects breed true?
It's always a mosaic pattern of defect. So we haven't seen, at least I haven't looked specifically at this, but if we have an animal with a craniofacial, does its offspring have the exact same craniofacial? I've never seen that.
So why?
We have a, sorry?
Why?
Well,
is that what you would predict?
We predict a mosaic effect because of the epigenetic. It's not a black and white genetic mutation. We have an epigenetic effect that's changing gene regulation slightly, so we think. So we could have maybe a more pronounced phenotype in one animal. Moreover, the older the animals are, for the transgenic males, if they're exposed to the transgene longer, the sperm could be more altered than an animal that's younger.
Okay, but in the non-transgenic, so if you were take a mouse with a craniofacial defect and you breed it again, and the offspring have craniofacial defects, or just suddenly you get offspring with extra digits? Like, how variable do your phenotypes range, I guess, in subsequent generations?
Well, it's always...
It's completely random again?
I'd have to do the exact statistics on that exact question, but yeah, it's
because from a developmental perspective, that would be particularly interesting to know how that works.
Okay.
One more question.
So in your non-transgenics, in your transgenerational phenotypes, so where did you see the loss of K4 dimethylation? So it looked like it wasn't in the trough. Is that right?
Yeah, we didn't see any changes in the non. Well, we saw very small number of genes that are changed in the non-transgenic.
I think that's really interesting. So there's a locus-specific effect on the canine dimethylation.
K4.
And these are in genic regions?
At the transcriptional start site is what we've looked at.
But not, you didn't see a decrease, you didn't see that trough again?
Not in the non-transgenic, no.
Okay. And were those genes interesting ones?
For the non-transgenic?
Yeah.
Well, yes, they were. But we...
Yeah. So you think that there is... But there is phenotypic effects, so... I see. So you're thinking that there is canine dimethylation changes that are then leading to more stable other histone changes, or? Okay. All right.
Just one more quick question. Follow up. Just... it's going to finish in a minute or in a second. Well, the most persistent abnormality was craniofacial malformation.
Yes.
Have you looked at, or did you have a chance to look at the neurocrest cells?
No, we haven't.